But first, singer-songwriter-piano-player Ben Folds. He's had a long, successful career as an unconventional icon. He's created genre-bending music throughout his solo work and as the frontman of the trio Ben Folds 5. Ben has released a memoir called A Dream About Lightning Bugs, A Life of Music and Cheap Lessons. I sat down with him backstage before a recent show in Madison. Ben talked about his life and career and why the early Ben Folds 5 sound was brutish.
Well, the idea was to not serve the song, because the songs had lives before Ben Folds 5, and they hadn't been successful. You know, like, I'd been playing those in little clubs by myself. I'd made demo tapes for years. It had all more or less been rejected. And we just kind of stumbled upon the power of just beating the songs up. I think in the book, I use the image of the suitcase commercial where the monkeys are beating up the suitcases. If they can stand that, then they're good suitcases. And that was their quality control. It's kind of like that with my songs. I mean, we turned the vocal down. The vocal was, I wasn't a grand singer trying to do everything that I could for the song necessarily. The distorted bass was louder sometimes than the vocal, and cymbals were bashing, and I was playing wrong notes. I mean, it was really pretty raucous stuff. But in the middle of it is a song that could be like a Broadway hit. Mm. So the idea was just like, let's put that kid in a rough neighborhood and let him get beat up some.
I'd like to tell you everything. 'Cause nothing changes, ever changes, doesn't seem the same these days.
As you write in your book, you know of no precedent for a full-time guitarless piano rock trio in the mainstream when Ben Folds 5 started. Do you think that was the band's USP, unique selling proposition?
Yes, definitely. We were the piano band that rocked, the piano band that would go play on a grunge stage, and that was a big part of it. You know, I dedicate a little time in the book to exploring the successful moments of piano rock prior to us. Emerson, Lincoln, Palmer is a good example, but most of the time that's organ. Most of the time that's distorted B3. Then when it's piano, the piano is greatly affected with, you know, all kinds of effects. And Elton John did that 11-17-70 album, which wasn't intended to be an album. It was just a live show. He would have preferred to have more players, but they were on a budget. They were doing their first U.S. tour. God, I think it brings out the incredible pianist in Elton. You know, like, that's some of his best piano playing. But yeah, so I felt like I could safely say that we were the ones that committed to it in the studio and everything. You know, we came along in an era where there seemed like everything had been done. And in a way, in rock and roll, maybe it kind of all had. I mean, rock is not the innovative force that it was. It's gone to R&B and that side of music.
Ben, at one point in your memoir, you describe yourself as a songwriting sociopath. What do you mean?
Did I say that?
Yeah, you did.
Sociopath. I think that I am often disconnected emotionally from what I'm writing. Not on purpose, but just because my main mission is to write a great song. Randy Newman likes to say he would run over his grandmother for a song. And I like to say that I would run over Randy Newman's grandmother for a song, too.
I thought you were just going to say I would run over Randy Newman for a good song.
I'd run over his grandmother for a song, too. I'd save Randy Newman for a couple more songs, at least. But no. So what I probably meant out of that was probably a lot of conditions that exist in someone who is not emotionally attached would exist in a lot of songwriters and a lot of story writers. Mm-hmm. Because you're putting the lab coat on and you're writing the best song. My interest is in writing songs. And the best song communicates. So then my interest is in communication, but only secondly to the fact that I want to build a song that I'm proud of that moves. I mean, and any amount of fraudulence that is required to go into the song to make it as good as it can, I'm totally willing to do that. But I've just found it's easier, more reliable to stick with the truth. mm-hmm. which is the way I look at life in general.
I was struck by how your memoir contains so much creative advice. And one of your observations that really stuck with me came from the Ben Folds 5 era. There was this quote you have, "We were learning that if something didn't make sense, it might be worth exploring because it meant nobody else was doing it."
Right.
Can you give me an example of how you, Robert, and Darren took advantage of that discovery?
Yeah. I mean, just the very fact that we were piano-based drums was one of them. And another thing was the distortion, not only of the bass, but the distortion of perspective that we depended upon. The background vocals needed to be as loud as the vocal, and the bass needed to give all that a good run for its money. The perspective that we required, and all music requires a perspective. You listen to Nat King Cole, and suddenly Nat King Cole was the quietest thing in the mix. It'd be very suspicious. If you got an engineer, and we're a baby band like we were, we tell the engineer, here's how we want to hear it. The engineer is going to say, well, that's ridiculous. It doesn't work that way. Oh, it doesn't, does it? Awesome. Maybe it does work that way then. We just came to feel that anything that got resistance was, you know, advance until apprehended is the way we felt. Even a band like Queen had broken a lot of rules, but did it in a way where you just really stressed the obvious. You know, you got a great singer, put that singer straight up front. Hell, overdub them, make 15 of them. Massive harmonies. Now, really exaggerate what they did. By the time we came along, you really needed to be looking at other things and exaggerating other things. You don't want to do what your parents did.
You mentioned a line from your song Phone in a Pool in your book, and the line is,
"Seems must be good for the music, hasn't always been so good for the life."
And I read in an interview that you wanted to reverse that lyric in the rest of your book.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, because, well, there's a lot of different ways to look at it, and I don't know what I really believe. I felt at the time, the assumption was, when I wrote that line, was that a kamikaze lifestyle can result in some tragedy. But that kind of thought applied to art is often very useful. And, of course, the worst thing that could happen is that your song sucks. So I think that was what I was thinking, was that the risk that I took in my art were being mirrored in my life, and it wasn't working for me in life. What I actually came to the conclusion after writing the book was that I was conflating a few things. I actually wasn't being kamikaze in my writing. I was actually just being brave and honest, which seems riskier than it is, because you have to take those risks. In my personal life, I was doing stunts, and I was also repeating mistakes over and over again. I was doing things that should have been seen to me as insane jumps off into the deep end that were unnecessary, and I'd already proven to myself that those things were not successful and make you sad.
Can you give me an example?
Well, I got married over and over again. Mm-hmm. That's a good one. So in the book, I was just kind of trying to, you know, show how one learns from the other, then the other learns from the other. Eventually, I started learning from my songwriting, because my songwriting was far more developed than my personality was, I thought. And I was able to go, well, what would my songwriting guy do? Well, he'd do that. Oh, I don't want to do that, you know. So in my real life, I'd have to do something I wasn't comfortable with, because that's what I would do in my songwriting.
Yeah. Do you think that there's a particular song that you've written that kind of embodies that shared sense of discovery that you mentioned?
Well, I think they all do if they're successful. It's a numbskull. It's kind of a pinheaded story. The song Brick is just simply a story. It's just a story of two kids, teenage abortion. It's a pretty heavy story, but, you know, at the very end, it gets to the point where it says,
she's alone, and I'm alone.
When you hit that next chorus, it's a different chorus. Hmm. You've now come to a different place. And it's always a subtle thing. Like that's what makes it, that's what the art is.
Rocking the Suburbs is the title track from your 2001 debut album as a solo artist after leaving Ben Folds 5. What inspired you to write a song about the suburbs?
Well, I realized that there was a whole decade radio formats that were just dedicated 24/7 to white middle class anger. That's what that stuff was. Modern rock radio was white middle class anger. They were screaming all the time. Everything was bad. everything was minor. Everything was loud, fuzzy, pissed off.
Let me tell y'all what it's like being male, middle class, and white. It's a bitch if you don't believe. Listen up to my new CD, Sham On.
You know, you took it for granted after a while. I wanted to poke fun of it, and as I thought about it, I was like, okay, I'm making fun of this, but there's something to it. I thought about Stevie Wonder growing up black and blind in a pretty rough time relative to civil rights. I think he had something to be pissed off about, but all his songs aren't angry. They're love songs or happy songs, all kinds of songs. So he'd actually been through it, so he could appreciate the good sides. And the middle class white guys that are so pissed off. Yeah, I know we're taxed a lot. Yeah, I know we work two or three jobs, and it is rough, and it's not nice to be taken for granted. I think the middle class is taken for granted. But still, I still don't quite get it. And I didn't get it. So you get a song written by someone who's kind of poking fun at it, who doesn't get it. And someone can say, yeah, well, you made it. Well, I was 27. I was waiting tables. I was an adult and was in debt and broke and poor, and I work hard now, and I get that. And I also get that as a white guy, there's things I can't say now. It's not our time in a way. And I think that's awesome. I think, you know, everyone should have to be undeniable to succeed. And white guys have gotten a great shake, you know, for a long time. But while the anger, I don't know. And the song has no answers. I was just being absurd.
Mm-hmm.
And it could have been a lot more serious, I guess, if I'd written it with more wisdom.
Yeah. I want to ask you about what is probably my favorite Ben Folds song, Landed, which, of course, is from your second solo album, Songs for Silverman. It's very beautiful and poignant. And to my ears, I think it's the chord progression of the piano riff that it has kind of a country vibe to my ears. And I think those vocals are among your best vocals, especially the falsetto during the chorus. Can you tell me a bit about Landed?
Yeah, it came to me walking on the beach where I lived in Adelaide, Australia at the time. And I was thinking about my brother-in-law. And I really wrote it from what I thought was his perspective. It turns out it was from my perspective, as those things often discover them later on. But, you know, there was a time where he was working in a coal mine. So I can see that maybe if I wanted to connect with him, that I was connecting the music in a little more country sort of way. Then there's an interesting modal shift into the chorus. Suddenly the seventh scale degree is flat. It's just a different mode you wouldn't normally hear alongside the verse, which stays in the same key, but almost sounds like it's changed keys. Back to my lab coat. That's what I was really drawn to. It sounded stormy suddenly, and it sounded like the footing of the tonality was being questioned for a second. And that to me seemed like a powerful place to put a story.
The subtitle of your book is A Life of Music and Cheap Lessons. What is the most valuable cheap lesson that you've learned in your life?
God, you know, they all are, because like, you might not look up to cross the street and have someone have to slam on brakes in front of you and scream at you. You know, oh, Jesus, I shouldn't be looking down at my cell phone while I'm crossing the street. I just was that guy. Told my kids not to do it, and then I did it myself. Man, I don't know. I can't remember that happened to me recently, but stuff like that happens all the time. And you're kind of like, okay, that's the most valuable one, because I would end up dead. By nature, there are lessons that things that could actually kill you.
Ben Folds 5 was loud, brutal music, as we were talking about earlier. Now you're frequently performing with orchestras. What is the difference for you between leading a three-piece band and now leading an orchestra?
Orchestra is like a big oil barge that is very difficult to turn around. Robert and Darren and I were more like a small race car where we could turn on a dime. Robert and Darren and I were more like a garage band where you communicate in very, very emphatic grunts, and you vocalize everything, you make everything obvious in rehearsals. That wasn't good. Do that again. No, do it like this. 1, 2, 3. No. one, two, three. It's like that. Orchestra is like, there's such a pecking order, not pecking order, such a protocol and such a lot of rules necessary to make it work. If you count off in rock music, you go one, two, three, four, and you start. Big band, a one, a two, and you start. Orchestra, and then you start. Or watch a baton go up. There's nothing to triangulate to so that you actually know what the groove is. I find it a big mystery. If something's not very good, they don't really speak to each other directly. It's you know, half of it's Italian. A lot of it is understood that it will land that night. Some of the things of the concert masters, Boeings and those issues, and there's a library involved. And so there's a huge difference. At the end of the day, it ends up being the same thing. But the way of getting there is, and I think orchestras could learn a lot. I mean, my work at the Kennedy Center with the National Symphony Orchestra, a lot of it is just about trying to bring some garage band wisdom into the symphony orchestra sometimes.
Ben Folds, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ben Folds is a singer, songwriter, and pianist. His memoir is A Dream About Lightning Bugs, A Life of Music and Cheap Lessons. Find out more about Ben at wpr.org/beta.
My biggest takeaway from this experience is that the Oscars gets a lot of stuff wrong.
Writer Shea Serrano on his cinematic thought experiments. That's coming up in a minute. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you.